Bob, are we ready to go? We're ready to go. Welcome, everybody. I really appreciate you coming today. My name is Shannon Chaffin. This is John Fox. We're from Alshire and Winder, and we're here to help you through the process known as the AB123 Ethics Training, which is, yay, not that exciting, but anyway, we'll do our best. Just so you know, this has been noticed as a meeting for all of the relative committees and everyone else that's supposed to be here today. So technically it is open. We're doing it in an open and public fashion. However, since it's a workshop, we may not necessarily have a public commentary period. So we're going to be going forward on that. I would like to ask you, for those of you who have phones, which is probably most of you, you don't have to turn them off. But if you leave them on, I reserve the right to run out and answer them for you if they ring. So if you would, please shut those off if you have a moment.
That one didn't count.
Huh? Want to do a quick summary of today's training. The reason for we're doing the training today is because the law requires it. And it's required by AB 1234, and it's also the fiduciary member duty of each board member in order to learn these sorts of things. We're going to divide it into four basic parts. Laws related to personal financial gain, laws related to perks of the office, laws related to government transparency and openness, and laws related to fair process. Now, if you're sitting here, you're probably supposed to be attending. That's the general rule. And generally we have elected officials and people who have been appointed members of boards and commissions who receive compensation for their services or who are reimbursed for expenses, and also employees who file statements of economic interest. So if you file a Form 700, this is probably a good place for you to be today. Now, the training of public officials is actually required under the government code. And among other things, it covers not only just core laws, but it also covers ethics, which is kind of interesting because I've always wondered, how can you teach ethics? But they have us here anyway to at least go over some basic ethical principles. When are you required to do it? Within 1 year of taking office, and training every 2 years. And this, to me, raises an interesting question, because the laws are so complex, they change every single year. And they've been changed every single year. But you're only trained once every 2 years. So things can change. Just keep that in mind. And whether or not you've been through the training is also a public record. Now, our learning objectives for today is we want to comply with AB 1234. So we're going to do a review of the core laws, and so we know not about the laws. Honestly, this is so complex, you're not going to remember it all unless you do this all the time. Our goal today is to help you recognize those situations when that little flag goes off and says, wait a second, that attorney that asked me about my phone said something about this. And it's at that point we'd like you to have that flag go up to say, you know what, maybe I better follow up on this. Let me talk to the city attorney or the agency attorney in order to help me through this process and see if everything is right. And it's basically to alert you as to which financial interests you may have that are reportable, what sort of transactions are also would be something to trigger this. And it's also to advise you of what happens if you don't do what you're supposed to do, because they have added very substantial teeth to these. And so this is one of the reasons that we're going through the training, because I hope that you never have an interesting issue under these items. Because when it gets interesting, there's usually somebody that wants to, well, send you to a nice place for a few, a year or whatever the case is if you're doing a misdemeanor. So hopefully this doesn't become interesting to you at one point, and you'll be able to see the issues as they come up. Now, the Attorney General's Office and the Fair Political Practices Commission require the training to include a discussion of values and an explanation of the importance of avoiding the appearance of impropriety. That's a nice way of saying they're trying to teach you some ethics. Now, as I've said before, sometimes it's a little bit difficult to do. How can you teach someone ethics? But we're at least going to outline the principles that they would like us to do. And so if you see us talking about ethics today, it's not that I'm trying to push my own personal agenda as to what is ethical and not ethical, which would be somewhat ironic coming from an attorney. But nevertheless, we are going to be doing those principles that have been set out as the basic fundamental principles for good government, open practice, and to avoid the avoid the appearance of wrongdoing. Now, ethics laws are merely the set minimum standards for conduct. And they go a little bit beyond the legal requirements. The legal requirements are here. The ethical requirements are about here. But you can have your personal ethics be even higher than that. It's up to you. But we're outlining the range and mode of what's permissible. It's about doing more what ought to be done rather than what's required. So what are the universal ethical values? Well, there's four of them. Trustworthiness, respect, fairness, and responsibility. So what do these values mean in the context of being a public servant? It's easy to say those four words, but what does it actually mean? Well, let's go to the first one. If I can get this to flip around, there we go. Trustworthiness. There's a lot of different aspects to trustworthiness. There's service to your community. There's truthfulness to colleagues, staff, and the public. There's not using your position for personal gain. It's keeping promises. It's not accepting gifts or other special considerations. And it's not knowingly using false or inaccurate information. You can be wrong. Just don't lie. The next core principle is respect. And you can tell the people who follow this by what sort of meetings you have a lot. And one of the very first ones up here you'll see is debate courteously. Avoid personal attacks. That includes not only on other board members, but also on the members of the public as well. Listen, prepare for meetings, include others and the public in the decision-making process, and be approachable and open-minded. Respect. After respect, we have fairness. And that is, everybody's concept of fairness is a little bit different. And I've noticed that I like my concept of fairness more than other people's concepts of fairness is because my concept of fairness is usually better for me. It's odd how that works out. But for the purposes of this course, fairness is basing the decisions on the merits and the fact. It is following the procedures. It is following the law. It is following the ordinances and the resolutions that have been set up. So everybody knows what's happening. It's about keeping an open mind, being consistent and impartial, and supporting the public's right to know, and when necessary, recusing yourself if there's the appropriate conflict, or, as an ethical consideration, if you feel it would be appropriate to avoid the appearance of wrongdoing or impropriety. And then as a final matter, there's responsibility. There's a responsibility to protect and care for the public agency's resources, admitting mistakes and moving forward, representing the agency's position even when you personally disagree with it, safeguarding confidential information. And since that one is near and dear to my heart, I will actually repeat it one more time. Safeguarding confidential information. It really helps avoid unnecessary attorneys' expenses and costs by doing that. Do not make promises that are unrealistic, and do not use information for personal advantage. Some of you are in very unique positions of authority, and there's opportunities to use that in many circumstances for personal advantage. I would highly urge you not to go down that road because it creates so many different issues. Now, that we've gotten a little bit through ethics, I'm going to turn the time over to John Fox, and he will talk to you about laws regarding financial gain.
Good afternoon. It's great to be with you. Get that. So the next segment, part one, is to talk about the laws regarding financial gain. And what we're going to be talking about are the criminal laws, the conflicts of interest under the Political Reform Act, conflicts of interest in city contracts, and what the distinctions are and what your responsibilities are if you have a financial interest, just a regular financial interest as opposed to one in a contract with the city, a conflict of interest and campaign contributions, and conflicts of interest after leaving office. So what's the purpose of these laws? And really, the purpose is that public officials should be making decisions based solely on the public interest, not based upon their private interest. And the prospect of financial gain or avoidance or detriment to personal interest must not affect decision making. And I know that here we have council members, we have members of various boards and advisory committee and commissions, but this also applies to staff. And we're going to be talking about financial conflict of interest. And we'll talk about, if you're a staff member, how do you deal with those financial conflicts of interest? And if you're a board member or a council member, how you deal with them. And there's some distinctions between them. So first of all, we're going to talk about the criminal laws. And the first area we're going to talk about is bribery. And what is bribery? You know, here's the definition. It's requesting, receiving, or agreeing to receive money or other advantages in exchange for an official vote, opinion, or action. So one of the key things, it's not just about money. It's also about other advantages. And what happens if you are convicted of bribery? State prison and disqualification from public office and public employment, not for 1 year, not for 2 years, not for 5 years, but for the rest of your life. So the consequences are pretty significant. In fact, the statute says any person engaged or found to have engaged in bribery forfeits his or her office, employment, or appointment and is forever disqualified from holding any office, employment, or appointment in this state. So, what involves value? So, here are some examples of things that you may receive that would constitute value. One is free admissions or discounted admissions that aren't offered to other people. Discounts on things. Let's say a developer of a new mixed-use development offers you a 30% discount on a brand new condo if you support or vote for the project. That would be considered a discount that would constitute a bribe. So that's an example. Trips, privileges. Again, privileges that are not provided to members of the general public. Contracts. Let's say the same developer, in your day job, you have a company that does architectural design work, and they state if you support this project, we'll give you a contract for architectural work on either this project or another project. That would constitute a bribe. Preferential treatment. Vote trading. This is something that is kind of eye-opening. If one council member were to say to another council member, if you vote for my project, I will support and vote for your project. That direct type of trading in votes would constitute a bribe. Now, that gets a little tricky because obviously council members are looking for support for their various projects, and so you just need to be very careful if you're a member of an advisory board or a council member in how you describe how you're seeking your support, because you don't want to fall into the trap of it appearing that you're trading a vote in order for one of your projects. Future school tuition or benefits, and then agency position or employment. So as can be seen, it's just not about money when you're dealing with bribery. You're dealing with many other aspects of what would be considered financial gain or something of value. And so just be careful if those types of issues come up. It would also apply, of course, if you're not on a board and you're working as an employee or a public official, which all of you basically are. If someone comes to you and says, if you'll approve this contract, you'll get a benefit of some type. Those are the things that you should be concerned about. So now we have the federal definition, and the federal definition is when you directly or indirectly gives, offers, or promises anything of value, or demands, seeks, receives, accepts, or agrees to accept anything of value. And the fine is 3 times the value of the bribe, 15 years in prison, and loss of office. So obviously the penalties are pretty significant. Just to summarize, jail time, loss of office, and unemployment in the state. And in addition to those, you also face the public embarrassment caused if you're convicted of accepting a bribe. And then, of course, the impacts on your family. So the consequences go beyond just the legal consequences. There are other consequences as well. So next we're going to be talking about the Political Reform Act and talking about financial conflicts of interest. And the Political Reform Act is administered by the Fair Political Practices Commission, and it's the most detailed disclosure law in the nation. And I want to stress that because, as Shannon stated, all we can do today is give you an overview of these laws. If you have a situation where you believe you may have a financial conflict of interest, the actual analysis to make a final determination is very fact-specific and very complex. And you'll get a little taste of it as we go through each of these rules and regulations. So the earlier that you can inform your city attorney or agency attorney that you would like to discuss a potential financial conflict of interest, the more likely that a reasoned approach can be provided to provide an opinion. The later you wait in order to get such an opinion, the more conservative the attorney's advice will get. And if you're asking regarding whether there's a financial conflict of interest within hours of needing to take a vote on something, the advice will probably be you need to recuse yourself out of an abundance of caution. Or if it's involving a public contract, the recommendation would be that the matter be continued until we work through the issues related to the potential conflict of interest. So as Shannon stated, if you're come into a situation where you think you might have a financial conflict of interest, notify a legal counsel or your supervisor earlier rather than later so that the issue can be addressed quickly. Amended every year since enactment, and that's the truth, and in 2014 there were some significant changes in the Political Reform Act, and we're going to talk about some of those. And it requires disclosure and reporting. So you need to disclose the conflict if you have one, and then you need to report various economic interests. And we'll be talking about the Form 700, which you fill out annually, which sets forth your economic interests. It requires adoption of a conflict of interest code by public agencies, and I just worked with the Morro Bay City Clerk on updating Morro Bay's conflict of interest code so that we could update all the positions that are subject to the conflict of interest code. So what happens if you have a financial conflict of interest? And we're going to discuss what those are. Well, you need to do 2 things. You need to disqualify yourself and you need to disclose the conflict. It's not just good enough to state, you know, I'm abstaining from a vote or I'm disqualifying myself from a particular matter. You need to disclose what the nature of the financial conflict of interest is. And then we're going to talk now about what triggers disqualification and disclosure. As we get into this, just keep in mind that because you have a financial conflict of interest, that is not unlawful. Lots of people have financial conflicts of interest. Many people, if you own a home in Morro Bay or a piece of property in Morro Bay, there is a possibility that you may have a financial conflict of interest at some point, based upon where a project is in relation to your home or piece of property. So it's not unlawful in and of itself. The issue is if you handle it incorrectly, then that's where you get in a situation where you're not complying with the law. So the Political Reform Act, and we're going to spend just a minute here, it prohibits a public official from making, participating in, or in any way attempting to use his or her official position to influence a governmental decision in which he or she has a financial interest. If a public official has a conflicting financial interest, he or she must recuse self and not participate in the matter. So, a public official has a conflict of interest if the decision will have a reasonably foreseeable material financial effect on his or her economic interests or that of an immediate family member, unless the effect is indistinguishable from the effect on the public generally and the official participation or the official participation is legally required. Now, the definition for purposes of the Political Reform Act of the term immediate family is your spouse or your dependent children. It doesn't include your parents. It doesn't include your uncle. It doesn't even include your brother or sister. So there is a certain amount of limitation as to what immediate family is, but there may be other circumstances where you may need to recuse yourself under the concept of the common law bias, but we'll talk about that later in the presentation. So when you're determining whether or not you have a financial conflict of interest that would require you to recuse yourself, you need to ask four questions. The first question is, will you be participating in the decision? The second, does the decision affect your economic interests? Three, is the effect of the decision on your economic interest material? And does the decision affect your economic interest differently than the public generally? So here are some examples of what would be considered making, participating in, or influence a governmental decision. Voting, appointing a person, or entering into a contract, or making a decision. Negotiations, research, investigation, and advice are participating in a decision. Contacting agency staff is considered influencing a decision. But ministerial or secretarial or manual clerical work is not covered, is not under this definition. And then representing your personal interests, such as negotiating for your own salary, is also exempt. So you can see that the definition of participating or influencing a decision is rather broad, and it would cover many mid-level to upper-level staff members as well as members of advisory committees who may influence decisions regarding the projects that are under the jurisdiction of their committees, whether it's the Public Works Commission or another commission. So here's some examples of what a financial interest includes. An investment of $2,000 or more in a business entity, It can include investments owned by spouse, dependent children, or trust, but not include bank accounts, mutual funds, money market funds, insurance policies, and government bonds. Or if you serve as an officer, director, or employee, or hold any business position in a business, you have a financial conflict, you have a financial interest, and a source of income of $500 or more in the last 12 months, or source of gifts of $460 or more in the prior 12 months. And we're going to talk more detail about gifts and the receipt of gifts and the disclosure of gifts. And the definition of reasonably foreseeable material financial effect on you or your immediate family that is distinguishable from the public generally. And it's important to note it can be an increase or a decrease in that financial effect. So just because you make a decision or you participate in a decision that would actually hurt you financially, that's not exempt from this disclosure. If you have a material financial effect on you, you fall within this these rules. So at the very end there, it talks about distinguishable from the public generally. And that would seem pretty common sense. Okay, public generally, I can probably figure that out. Well, in order to determine whether or not that particular exemption applies, you have to go through yet another four-step process to evaluate whether or not that exemption would apply. So just, again, to stress the point that this area is very complex and very regulated, and something that appears to be common sense probably isn't when we're dealing with the Political Reform Act. So it's just one area where you need to be, you know, extremely careful. So what or who is involved? A person or entity that is a party to a proceeding. Your investment, income source, or gift is the subject of the decision. You are employed by or officer or partner in the business that is the subject of the decision. Any financial effect on your personal finance or of your immediate family, or you own real property within 500 feet of the subject of the decision. So in 2014, they changed the 500-foot rule. I'm sure many of you have heard of the 500-foot rule. Well, before 2014, the definition basically stated that if the project would affect the value of your property by one penny in either direction, that would be considered a conflict of interest. If you are located within 500 feet, if your property is located within 500 feet of the decision property. Well, they've kind of, in a one way, relaxed that standard, but in another way, they keep it complicated. So now, the new standard is you do not have a financial conflict of interest if there's no reasonably foreseeable, measurable impact on the official's property. So they've gotten rid of the one penny rule, which is the good news and provides more flexibility. But the second part is as important. The only agency that can make that determination is the Fair Political Practices Commission. So the city attorney can't make that decision. You can't make that decision. If you want to participate in a decision related to a project within 500 feet of your real property, you need to request an opinion from the FPPC. So let's say your property is located outside of 500 feet. Are you home free at that point? Well, the answer is no, because once again in 2014, they have changed this rule. We now have a new reasonably prudent person standard. It says, even if the property is beyond 500 feet, the official must consider whether a reasonably prudent person using due care and consideration would believe the governmental decision was of such a nature that its reasonably foreseeable effect would be to influence the market value of the official's property. That's a lot of words, but a couple of examples that we can provide. One is, let's say you own a piece of property that is has a wonderful view of the ocean, and there's a empty lot in front of your piece of property where you get your view to the ocean. And that lot, though, is more than 500 feet ahead of away from your piece of property. And someone comes in and wants to get a development permit for that property to construct a three-story, you know, mixed-use or condo development, something like that. And you have a sneaking suspicion that that's going to block your view. So even though it's outside of the 500 feet range, is it reasonably foreseeable that that project could have a financial effect on the value of your property? Probably so, because once you lose that unobstructed view, that would potentially affect the value of your property. So that's just one example of the types of things you'd be dealing with. There are new rules regarding leasehold interests. And basically, if you're dealing with an agreement on a lease that potentially changes the termination date of the lease or increases or decreases the potential rental value of property or increases or decreases the potential rental value and the official has a right to sublease the property, and change in the official's actual or legal allowable use of the property or impact on official's use or engagement of the property. So this could be the situation where you have a property that your business leases if your day job is not working for the city, and the city wants to do a general plan amendment or to change the land use in that area, which would potentially change the land use for that piece of property. That could either increase the value or decrease or the uses that you could have there. Well, you may have even though you're just leasing the property, it could affect your ability and the things you can do with the property affect you financially. So the other exception, we've already talked about the public generally exception, but the other exception, if you do have a financial conflict of interest, that would permit you to participate in a decision, even though you have such a conflict of interest, is the circumstance where you're legally required to participate in the decision. This comes up in the circumstance when you have a board or city council where, say you have a five-member city council, and three of the council members have a financial conflict of interest on this particular matter. Well, if three of the members have a financial conflict of interest that would disqualify them from participating, you would never be able to obtain a quorum in order to make a decision regarding the particular matter. That is the circumstance whereby you would be one of those three would be legally required to participate in the decision so that you would have a quorum. And the way you make that determination is usually through drawing of lots or pulling numbers out of a bag or something like that, something that would be considered to be random in the selection process. However, let's say you have a meeting of the city council or the board, the planning commission, for instance, and you have a five-member council or planning commission, and one member is gone, and two members have to conflict themselves out at that meeting on a particular project. So that would, again, leave two members left, which is less than a quorum, so you could not make a decision. Now, in that circumstance, assuming the person who's absent would not have a financial conflict of interest if they were actually present at the meeting, would not create a situation where the two that have the legally financial the financial conflict of interest would be legally required to participate. And why is that? Because if you continued the matter for one more meeting and made sure that that third person was there, then you'd have a quorum and you'd be able to make a decision. And so I'm going to turn it back over to Shannon.
Thank you, John. We're going to also talk about some conflicts of interest with regards to recusal and disqualification and how that's done. And sometimes we see that there's this concept that, well, if I just recuse myself at a certain stage in the process, I'm going to be okay because I've said, hey, I've disclosed what my interest is, and I've disclosed, and I'm not voting on it, and I'm leaving the room. Well, sometimes that's not enough. And when we talk about recusal and disqualification, this means that a public official is prohibited from participating in the decision being made by his or her agency. And the disqualification process applies to the vote and the entire process leading up to the vote. So if we get to the leave the room requirement, just not voting is not enough. You may not make, participate in, or influence any decision that will have a foreseeable and material financial effect on you, your immediate family, and any of your economic interests. So if you are, for example, a board member or a council member, and you are involved in the staff process or attending staff meetings on a particular item that would financially affect you, and you encourage a certain sort of staff recommendation or outcome or whatever the process may be, or even talk to other board or council members encouraging them to approve the project, and then when it comes the day of the council or board meeting, you say, I'm disqualifying myself, I'm leaving the room, that's not enough. It's the influencing part. And sometimes with influence, you don't even need to say a word. So, as we all have known from people who have sat there staring at us, and I think of my mom sometimes she didn't even need to say a word, and I knew that she was influencing my decision. So what does it mean to leave the room? It's not just enough to get up and say, okay, I got to leave now and just step out for the item. Instead, you need to publicly identify the financial interest or potential conflict of interest while at the meeting. I own property two doors down. I have a business investment in a competitor directly across the street or half mile away or whatever the case may be. Identify that on the record. Do not attempt to influence the decision in any way, including pre-meeting discussions with staff or colleagues. Notice I mentioned that twice. Ask that the item be considered separately if on the consent calendar. And that's tricky sometimes because, as you know, there's a whole list of things that are on the consent calendar, and if your item is one of them, and since all of them are voted on together, you can't just say, well, I abstain from this one and I'm voting on all the other items. The problem with that is you haven't publicly disclosed and you haven't left the room during the vote. So the proper mechanism is to ask for the item to be separately voted on, vote on all the remaining items, disclose and leave while the board or council or agency does the last item on the consent calendar. That way it keeps it clean. And then, of course, leave the room until after the discussion, vote, or any other disposition of the matter. And I've also found it helpful if you tell somebody to come and get you after the vote's been taken, because there's sometimes everybody sitting around waiting for the board member or the council member to come back in. Now we're going to move on to campaign contributions. And I want you to know, just getting started, this is a little bit different what we have in the state laws, or in some ways a lot more regulated than they are at the federal level. And for example, you can see presidential candidates or whoever the case may be, or even the president being able to go out and make speeches and do fundraisers and do these, you know, certain sorts of things that you can't do yourself here. So there's certain restrictions that we have. So just because I may see it on TV and say, oh, hey, wow, you're charging this much for a plate, that's great. Can't do it here. We have additional restrictions and requirements. And these campaign contributions are special conflict rules that apply to proceedings on licenses, permits, and other entitlements for use pending before certain state and local boards and agency. And there's a basic prohibition, and that is covered officials are prohibited from receiving or soliciting campaign contributions of more than $250 from parties or other financially interested persons during the pendency of the proceeding and for 3 months after its conclusion. So the pendency of the proceeding, that can cover a lot of territory.
Shannon, I just want to make one clarification here. This particular statute does not apply to elected officials. It applies to individuals that are appointed to a particular commission or committee, which is kind of interesting. If you're on the Planning Commission, you cannot accept a $250 campaign contribution under these circumstances. But if you're an elected official on the City Council, you would be able to do that. So it's kind of an interesting little distinction. However, one other area is, let's say you're an elected official who's been appointed to serve on another committee, such as LAFCO or something to that effect, then you are probably precluded from accepting $250 campaign contributions under this particular statute because of the fact that you're appointed to another commission or committee.
And frankly, I wouldn't be very surprised to kind of see some changes in this particular one, especially with regards to the example of the planning commissioner who couldn't accept the campaign contributions, but the city council member who could. And it could be possible you have situations where they're running for the same office, but one's able to accept and another one is not. I could see some potential changes in that law in the future, but as I said, these laws change constantly, so they're a moving target. This is the best that we have right now. Now, when this occurs, disqualification is required. Any covered official, who has received more than $250 in campaign contributions in the 12 calendar months prior to the matter being submitted to the agency, application being filed, or brought before the board, is required to disqualify themselves. So what happens if this is violated? What are the consequences? Well, first of all, there's some pretty hefty fines. And there's also potential criminal prosecution. There is, of course, the loss of reputation and then the family impacts. The one thing that we as attorneys really liked not to see is we like not to see names of our public entities, officials, and staff members on the front page of the newspaper. We really do not like seeing that, especially when it comes to AB 1234, ethics, conflicts of interest, and these sorts of things. So when it's come to that point, the loss of reputation that a family impacts, we've seen these things happen in other jurisdictions, and they can be absolutely devastating. So we really hope that doesn't occur here. So if you ever do have any questions, again, think back to, gosh, those guys were talking about something. Maybe I better ask the attorney about this. So let's talk about a little bit about contracts. Now, interests and contracts are prohibited. And the general rule is that a public official may not have a financial interest in any contract made before them in his or her official capacity or by a board or a body of which he or she is a member. And the key to remember this is contracts in the state of California don't necessarily have to be in writing. If you come up with some sort of deal and it meets the necessary requirements, it can be an oral contract. So, the impact of that is if any one board member is financially interested in a board decision, the entire agency is disqualified. Now, every time I state this, I always see the looks of, really? How can that be? How does one person taint the entire board or the entire agency? And the thought process runs something like this. Let's say I'm Council Member Shannon, And I own the Ford dealership, and it's the only Ford dealership in town. And the municipality is looking to replace their police vehicles. And I say, wow, do I have a deal for you? I will completely undercut all of our costs. I will give these vehicles not only at cost at which I purchased them, but I will knock off an additional 10% for you. I am literally going to be losing money on this deal. Sounds like a great deal for the city, doesn't it? Even though I'm a council member that's losing it. Now, because there's a contract involved, if you're going to award the contract for the purchase of these vehicles, obviously I would have to be disqualified. But the question is why does the rest of the board have to be disqualified? Because if I were making a profit, regardless of whether or not I was making a profit, they would all know. It's kind of this one of these wink, wink, nudge, nudge things. Sure, you step to the side. We'll make the vote on this contract, and then we'll see what happens. Because in other situations, and the reason why these laws have been put into place, you have council members with business entities or agency board members with business interests making a contract with a governing body, stepping out, and it was very interesting how many of times they got awarded the contract, even when there are other potential contracts out there. And the state legislator said, you know what? We don't even want to go there. We want to avoid the appearance of impropriety. And the concept is if you have one board member or one council member and they have a conflict of interest, a financial interest in this contract, it taints the entire board. So one of the worst things that we just it drives you nuts as an attorney sometimes, and I'll be honest with you, is when you have all these complex laws that are going on, and 2 minutes before the vote, a board member or somebody comes over to you and says, hey, do I have a conflict? And then they start telling you all these factual considerations, and there's so many different facts. And so what typically, as John said before, is under these circumstances, we don't know if recusal of one is enough or recusal of the entire board or city council is enough. So generally our advice at the last possible moment like that is continue the item. Continue the item until we can assess this because there are so many factors involved. But again, just because the one board member steps out, just because the one council member steps out, it's not enough. Yes?
So what if you own mutual fund?
I'm glad you asked. That's actually exceptions. You read my mind. That's perfect. That's perfect. Oh, I'm sorry. The question was asked, well, Shannon, what if you own mutual funds or something? And I said, great, here we are. There is actually a list. Of course, because it's our legislature, they put lists out of everything. And the lists specify exceptions to the general rule. And the first one is a list of public services generally provided on the same terms and conditions. Governmental salary, unless the contract is with your department, still requires disclosure. And a remote interest. List of statutory exceptions and everything is there for salary exceptions and certain procedures. So let's talk about a remote interest. Suppose that you had mutual funds in, let's say, McDonald's. And a McDonald's was coming into your jurisdiction, and you were part of the decision-making process as to whether or not a McDonald's could be built on a certain lot. And it came up for vote, and you came to, you voted for or against the McDonald's. It doesn't really make a difference. And somebody came up and said, well, wait a second. I looked at your Form 700 disclosure, and I see that you own some mutual funds. And some of those mutual funds I also checked online as well, and it turns out they've invested in McDonald's stock. And you have roughly, potentially, $5,000 in McDonald's stock. Now, under those circumstances, it's such a remote interest. $5,000 as compared to the total funding of McDonald's is it's a drop in the bucket. Whether or not that particular McDonald's is approved or not approved really doesn't have any sort of substantial impact. It's a very remote impact. However, if you own the McDonald's franchise that's at question, that is not a remote interest. So keep that in mind. Mutual funds, generally remote interest. Even if you go ahead and bought the stock outright, generally a remote interest. If you have enough stock in a corporation, that you own a large chunk of McDonald's, now we're starting to get into other issues. Did you have a comment?
And again, we want to clarify here that we're dealing with just a general financial conflict of interest, as Shannon described. But let's say you owned stock in the mutual fund that had an interest in McDonald's, and McDonald's wanted to contract with the city. In that circumstance, because we're dealing with the 1090 issue, we'd also be dealing with remote interest issue, where that would probably be a remote interest. I'm pretty confident that it is. But if you owned the franchise and you wanted to enter into some sort of contract with the city, such as to provide Egg McMuffins every morning to the employees for a low cost, that would not be a remote interest, and that type of contract would be precluded by Government Code Section 1090.
Thank you, John. So what do we have for violations? Now, you start seeing certain themes after a while for violations. This is a little bit different than most themes. The very first thing on a 1090 violation is the contract is voided. It goes away. And you may have to disgorge any profits or anything else you made on it. The other thing is the offending board member must resign from the board, or potentially the irrevocable renounce an interest, unless an exception applies to the permit the board to act. Staff members in violation must be screened from the board action. Again, if you are a staff member, think about what financial interests not only you have, but your immediate family has as well as you're going through these processes, not only in this one, but the other one. So think about that as well. And the violation is a felony that can result in imprisonment of the public official and fines. And as you know, felonies are greater than 1 year. As a general rule, misdemeanors are a year or less. So felonies have a little bit more teeth to them. And we also talked about how laws change a lot. And it turns out we now have a new criminal law that goes into effect. And this one is very broad-reaching. Effective January 1st of this year, it is a felony to aid and abet a government official in violating conflict of interest in contract laws. Aid and abetting. Now, this raises some very interesting questions in my mind. So, if you have a council member or a board member going to the attorney at the last moment and says, oh, is this okay? And the attorney said, yeah, I think so. Ooh, that might be aiding and abetting. Wonder if the other board members are also involved in the process and may not know the financial interest, or they may know the financial interest but just didn't say anything. All of these things start raising some very interesting questions about what aiding and abetting is. So the general rule is you're probably going to get more conservative advice if you come in at the last moment. We also have some case law examples. We have three of them up here. The first one, it's very interesting. It doesn't matter that the contract is good for the public. It doesn't matter that you're getting a great deal at the Ford dealership that's below cost. It's still a conflict of interest. The next case, a sitting board member cannot be appointed as a general manager. And likewise, a council member appointed to the city manager position is prosecuted. Why is that? They're employment contracts. They could be written employment contracts. They could be oral employment contracts. They are engaged in a contract that will benefit them personally. We also have a doctrine called the incompatible offices doctrine. Now, that doctrine concerns a potential clash of two public offices held by the same person. It's like wearing two different hats. Now, it was a common law doctrine for a while. Common law means the courts decided it, but nobody really wrote it down in the statutes anywhere. They've now put it and codified it and wrote it down in the statutes for us. And it only applies to officers, not employees. So if you're not an employee, it doesn't apply to you, even though you may be wearing that hat in a different capacity. It's when you wear two hats of two offices that it comes into effect. And how that works is if the offices are incompatible is, let's say you were elected to be, on a council member, for a particular city, and then you are elected to be on the Board of Supervisors. Those are considered to be potentially two different incompatible offices. What happens is the first office is automatically forfeited as soon as you put on this hat. Automatically forfeited, and you are in the second office, which means that if you're running for what some people would consider a better office, and you're running for an office of, like, I don't know, a symmetry district or something like that, and it happens to be there incompatible, suddenly you could find yourself out of that first office and just in the second office. So remember that with offices. It depends which hats you're wearing. Now, if you... where are we? And the violations are, I think, are 1 year... Where are we? Codified employees, prospective employers. Yes?
How does that work with LAFCO and the Board of Supervisors?
Well, you want to handle that one, John, with the appointments to the committee?
Well, when you serve on LAFCO, that is one of the exceptions to the general rule regarding compatibility of office, because LAFCO is made up of public officials or elected officials from other committees and councils and the like. So that would be an exception to the general rule regarding incompatibility of offices. So.
And there are a lot of exceptions, and there are a lot of exceptions to the exceptions. So... then that's a perfect example. So if you do have any of these issues coming up, even before you start running for office, I would suggest you start asking about these particular matters so that you don't get in an uncomfortable situation. Now let's talk about prospective employers for a little bit. The law prohibits you may not influence a public agency decisions when the interests of a prospective employer are at stake. When there is negotiation or any arrangement concerning prospective employment with someone who has business before the agency. And just think about that. If they're going to be a prospective employer, you got to be careful. Revolving door limitations are next. What is a revolving door? That's where you have one person who's a public official going out and being appointed to something else, like a top-level manager, then jumping back in, or going out and representing people before the boards are commissioned for pay. And so one day they're commissioner, they're Commissioner Shannon, and the next day they're Advocate Shannon for whoever the business happens to be. What the general rule is that there was a one-year ban. You've got to have a gap from the time that you concluded office to this time you start moving forward. It applies to elected officials and top-level managers, including department heads. So if you're a department director, please take note of this. And you cannot represent individuals or entities before their agency. So if you were in the Department of Public Works and you were the director, and there was a paving company who wanted to get a contract after you'd retired, you've got to wait 1 year. Because if you were to do it before that time and represent them before the board or the council saying, hey, this is a great paving contractor, we worked with them before, they do a great job, and by the way, I'm getting paid by them to say this, or I work for them now, that raises some conflict of interest stuff. Now, just because these are minimum state law requirements, your local jurisdiction may actually adopt requirements that are even more strict than this. And again, this only applies if you receive compensation. So if you've retired and you're not being compensated, you still have the right to speak without compensation. Common law conflicts of interest. Now, common law, as I said before, is stuff that's not been codified, but the courts have said, yep, this is the way that we want it. We've interpreted the law this way. So a public office is impliedly bound to exercise powers contained on him with disinterested skill, zeal, and diligence, and primarily for the benefit of the public. Well, what's that mean? That means you can't be unduly biased, and you need to be exercising your power and authority and skill in a way that benefits the public. Courts and the attorney generals have continued to use common law, and they typically do for a while. So, I'm sorry, and there's your nice little PowerPoint. Not sure? Who do you call? Follow your agency policy. Usually your agencies have policies and they've written them down someplace. Second of all, you can contact the FPPC. They have a website, they have email addresses, they have contact information, you can call them. Sometimes you get an official response, it may take up to 3 months or more, so if you're really concerned about getting a written opinion, start early. Contact your agency counsel, and finally, there's nothing stopping you from contacting your personal attorney as well. And I'll turn this over to John.
All right. So we're running a little behind schedule, so we're going to speed up our slides here a little bit and get through the material. So the next section, we're going to be talking about key laws regarding perks of office. One's status as a public servant and one's access to public resources should not afford special privileges. And we're going to be talking about two categories. We're going to be talking about perks that others provide to public officials, and we're also going to be talking about public officials using public resources, such as staplers and copiers and those kind of things. Remember that no perks laws are here to promote those commonly held values that we talked about early on: fairness, respect, trustworthiness, and responsibility. Receipt of perks, as you probably know, if you ever hear about it on the radio, it really does undermine the public's trust and decision makers are treating everyone fairly and making decisions solely in the public's interest. No perks laws bar some transactions and require disclosure of others. So the first we're going to be talking about are gifts. And if you receive a gift, you must disclose it if it's worth $50 or more. If you're a public official, there is a maximum cap now of $460 that you can receive in gifts per calendar year. And this ceiling changes every other year. It began at about $250. Now, it's important to note that it's $460 per calendar year. We're going to be talking about a circumstance where, as we talked about earlier, where you receive gifts from that of $460 that also constitutes a financial conflict of interest if you receive them within the year of making a decision. So you have two different deadlines to keep in mind. Gifts include meals, travel payments, rebates, discounts, and discounts not offered to others. And again, an example is if you go to Best Buy and they are offering 20% discount to the general public, yes, you can accept that discount because everyone else is receiving it. But if Best Buy says, well, hello, Commissioner, glad to see you in our store, we'd like to give you a 30% discount on this new flat-screen TV, that would constitute a gift, and therefore you'd need to disclose it under these rules. What is receipt of a gift? A receipt means the recipient knows he or she is in actual possession and takes control of it, and except for tickets or passes, discarding of the gift does not negate receipt. Giving it to someone else also does not negate a receipt of the gift because you actually controlled the gift and you had the control over who would receive it. So you did receive the gift. So what are the exempt gifts? Gifts that are returned within 30 days of receipt. Gifts from close relatives. Thank God, right? Unused tickets, so if someone gives you tickets to go see a concert that you're really not interested in, you throw them out and you don't use them, that's an exception. Donate to nonprofit of the gift without claiming deductions, that's a key point. If you donate it to a nonprofit, don't claim the deduction. Donate to governmental agency without claiming any deductions. certain types of informational material that you receive at a conference. If you attend a League of Cities conference or other professional development conferences, you'll get some fancy material. That's exempt. Personalized plaques that are worth under $250. Hospitality in a friend's home, stay with a friend for a week, that's exempt. Stay with that same friend for a year, that's starting to get more like you're getting some sort of long-term housing, which may be a little seen a little differently. Gift exchanges for holidays and birthdays, reciprocal exchanges of lunches. You know, I'll buy your lunch this today if you buy my lunch next time. But again, make sure that you're following that and that it really is a reciprocal exchange and that you can prove it if someone ever questions you about it. And then, of course, inheritance. Items exempt from limit but must still be disclosed: wedding gifts, prizes from bona fide competitions, and some gifts of travel outside of California. Yes?
On the maximum, which shows 460, is that from one source or in aggregate?
It's from one source. So, yes, the 460 is from one source, not from many different sources. Yes, the question was regarding the 460 limit. That's from a single source. It's not in the aggregate. So you could receive various gifts from various unrelated entities, and so long as you stay under that 460 per source, you're okay. All right. Gifts to an agency. So this is another area. Let's say that an agency receives a gift and the agency then distributes the gift to employees of the agency. And Regulation 89442 discusses how that will all play out. So under this rule, officials do not have to report tickets as gifts if tickets given to the agency for the sole purpose of distributing passes or tickets to agency officials and their spouses and immediate families and use tickets or passes is so limited. So this is a situation where an agency gets a whole bunch of tickets and then the agency makes the decision as to who receives them and perhaps has a written policy that sets forth how those tickets will be distributed. In that context, you would not need to disclose those tickets as gifts. However, there's still a further exemption where board members and certain executive staff, even in that circumstance, would not be able to receive those as gift to the agency, and they would have to report the gifts, and they are subject to conflicts and ethics limits. So what are the potential conflicts? You have the FPP civil action, penalty three times the amount of the gift, $5,000 fine, 6 months in jail. And again, because you're dealing with gifts, one gift is another person's bribe. And so you could also be dealing with the bribery laws. Back to Shannon.
Thank you. And after I'm finished here, we're going to take a quick five-minute break. So I know all of you are going to encourage me to go as fast as possible, so I hope you don't mind. There are constitutional prohibitions as well on what you can and can't do. For example, travel expenses from transportation companies are strictly forbidden. If you're a transportation company, you can't take it. You have immediate forfeiture of office, and it's applicable whether provided in connection with personal or public business. Additionally, receiving gratuities or rewards, you may not receive any kind of gratuity or reward for performing your duties of a public office. So if it's connected to your duties of a public office, you can't receive them. Same thing for honoraria. Payment is prohibited. This includes payments for speeches, articles, attending public or private conferences and meetings. And the key is officials should not be using their public office for gain. Now, there are always exceptions to all these rules. And for honoraria, there's the earned income exception. So if there are payments received for rendering services in connection with a bona fide business, trade, or profession is earned income and will not be prohibited under the honoraria ban. An income of $500 or more is reportable and may disqualify you from making decisions affecting that source of income. So you may have to report it. Now, may not use public resources for political campaign or personal use. What's this mean? You shouldn't be using city staff or agency staff, their office equipment, their office supplies, their staplers, their facilities, your office, whatever the case may be. Those are all public resources. And the penalty is, of course, criminal violation, jail, and disqualified from holding office. Now, there is an exception for incidental or minimal uses. But again, if you're in one of these situations, ask before you start engaging in the activity. Additionally, expense reimbursements. Now, that's a big question. How do we get reimbursed for travel? What about meals? How much of our meals? When does this occur? Well, the general rule is officials can only be reimbursed for the actual and necessary expenses. And what's actual? What's necessary? These are the questions attorneys ask all the time. Well, the agency should have adopted policies. In fact, they must adopt expense reimbursement policies that specify the kinds of activities that are reimbursable. So if you have an agency, ask to see their reimbursement policy, and it will tell you what they should be. The local agency must use expense report forms. Expenses must be documented with receipts. Keep your receipts. And these documents are public records and subject to disclosure. And occasionally newspapers will actually make requests for these to see who's been spending on what and what they're being reimbursed for and whether or not those expenses were indeed reasonable and necessary. There's also limits on public official compensation, and that's governed by the government code. And if you're a charter city, there may also be charter limitations within your charter limiting how much compensation you can get. Next, we have loans. There is a $250 limit, and officials cannot receive loans from those within the agency or with whom the agency contracts. What this means, if you're a council member or a department, if you're a council member and you go to one of the staff members and said, "Hey, I hear you just won the lotto. You mind giving me a loan? It's just a couple $100." This rule prohibits that. Should not be doing that sort of thing. It's designed to keep pressure off from the staff and from everyone else so they don't have these sorts of issues going on. So, personal loans for elected officials over $500 must meet certain requirements. They must be in writing. They must clearly state the date, the amount, and the interest payable. And bank loans or credit card debt payment must be made in the regular course of business or loans with the same terms available to the public generally are not subject to the rule. So if you're a public official and you're getting a loan from someone, it should be complying with these rules in writing so it's not one of those special loans, like John said before, like one person's gift is another person's bribe. One person's loan can be interpreted as another person's bribe. Mass mailings. I realize we're jumping from place to place here, but there's a lot of stuff to cover. Mass mailings at the public expense. You can't do it, but there are certain exceptions. And the exceptions are anything below 200 items or less, or substantially similar, within a single calendar month, paid for with public funds and delivered to a resident, business, or employment, or P.O. box. What this means is if you send out 199, you can do that once every calendar month for a year, and you can cover a lot of business and residences. But you can't exceed the once-a-month restriction. Additionally, no identification of your office except for a copy of the letterhead. No name, photograph, or reference to the official office. And no photos on business cards. This does not apply to mailings, not on only refers to mailings, not websites. So if you have a website up, you can put your picture there. So if you go to the state websites, you'll see pictures of the public officials on those websites. Next, the California Constitution forbids gifts of public resources or funds. You can't pay for spouses to accompany public officials. That's a misuse of public funds. And be careful when your agency considers a charitable contribution. You may need to make public benefit findings. You just can't give away public resources and public funds. Next, soliciting political contribution from agency employees is prohibited, except for communications to a significant segment of the public. In other words, if you're an employee and as part of a mass mailer, you get the please support Shannon Chaffin for office, that's fine. Coming up to you personally, if you work for the agency and I'm asking you for that, not fine. And violation is a misdemeanor, up to a year in jail. And you can't condition employment decisions based on support of a person's candidacy. Do you support this person or not? If you do, I'll hire you. If you don't, I won't. That's a no-no. Compensation decisions may not be tied to political support. And of course, there are misuse of public funds ramifications. With regards to these, it's up to 4 years in prison because it's a felony, $5,000 per violation. You have to do restitution to the agency. There could be attorney's fees, not only your attorney's fees, but the personal and opposing party's attorney's fees that you would have to pay, and you're barred for public holding public office. And we are now at the point, I think you all are looking forward for a break. We'll actually ask you to hold your questions. We'll catch it on the backside. We're going to do a five-minute break. We are going to start at 27 after, and we will get you out the door on time. Thank you.
So thank you again for your attention, and just for a quick recap, we covered financial transparency in parts one and two, and we're going to talk now about the economic disclosure form, the economic interest form, meeting transparency, and document transparency. So first we're going to talk about your requirement to fill out the Form 700. It's a statement of economic interests. As indicated, tomorrow night the City Council is going to consider updating the city's conflict of interest code that will identify and update the list of individuals that need to file Form 700s. It's my understanding that if you are invited to attend, you are required to prepare and fill out a statement of economic interest. So there are also some certain disclosure limitations depending on what position you have. So you may want to talk with Dana Swanson, the city clerk, to determine what the scope of your disclosure is depending on the position you're in. The deadline for completing your statement of economic interest and submitting it is April 1st. So there are rules regarding no nepotism. Many jurisdictions have adopted local rules in that, but generally you are not to participate in making decisions affecting immediate family, which would include spouse, domestic partners, or children. So now we're going to get on to the topic that many of you are more than familiar with. And it's the Brown Act, which is the requirements related to public meetings for various types of legislative bodies. Legislative body includes agencies, boards of supervisors and district boards, other legislative bodies or local government agencies created by state or federal law, boards or commissions of local government agencies, and standing committees of a legislative body. So just keep in mind that even if you're on an advisory committee, if that advisory committee has been established by formal action of the City Council, that will be subject to the Brown Act, unless it will be. Now, there are certain other types of ad hoc committees that are made up of a minority of the members of the City Council or of the Planning Commission, and those are not necessarily subject to the Brown Act. What's the intent of the Brown Act? It's public agencies exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business, and actions of public agencies are to be taken openly, and deliberations must be conducted openly. All meetings of the legislative body of a local agency shall be open and public. So the real question then is, what is a meeting? And so we're going to take just a minute here and talk about the definition of a meeting. A meeting is any congregation of a majority of the members of a legislative body at the same time and place to hear, it's interesting, hear, make sure, discuss or deliberate upon any item that is within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body or the local agency to which it pertains. So it's a congregation of a majority, but it includes not only discussing and deliberating upon, but also hearing. What is not a meeting? Individual contacts between one commissioner to another commissioner, attendance at conferences and other gatherings which are open to the public, as long as members do not discuss among themselves business of a specific nature under their jurisdiction. So a classic example is if you attend the conference for planning commissioners and you attend the same plenary session, that's fine, but if you're also sitting in the corner with a majority of the planning commissioners and you're discussing, wow, that's an interesting point they're making here. That relates to that project that we just had at the last hearing, or the future project that we'll be considering at the next hearing. You could potentially have a meeting under the Brown Act during that plenary session, which would, of course, violate the Brown Act. Attendance at social and ceremonial events. Ad hoc committees, we talked about an ad hoc committee. Meetings of other agencies, you can attend meetings of other agencies if you want to attend the Board of Supervisors meeting. Committees not created by formal action of the legislative body. So let's say that the city manager establishes a committee to address a particular issue. That was not established by the legislative body, and therefore it wouldn't be subject to the Brown Act. Yes?
Real quick question regarding the Brown Act. I was under the impression that you could meet as long as it wasn't a quorum. In other words, if we had a body of seven individuals, three people could meet outside a particular meeting to discuss anything that they wanted. Is that incorrect or correct?
No, that's correct. Going back to the definition of meeting, it states a majority.
Okay.
A majority. So, yeah. Any congregation of a majority, which would also include a quorum. But that's a very good question. Sure. The question was, could you meet with a minority number of members of a commission? So let's say it's a seven-member commission and you wanted to meet with two other members. You're a commissioner and you want to meet with two others. Yes, you can do that. However, we're going to be talking about examples where you could create a serial meeting situation, even if in one circumstance you are just meeting with one set of minority group of members. So the Brown Act does apply to collective briefings of a majority of the legislative body. So that would be a circumstance perhaps where the staff wants to brief the City Council on a particular matter. That briefing would need to be open to the public and noticed under the Brown Act if it included a majority of the council members. However, if they were to break it down into smaller groups of less than a majority, possibly, potentially, you could avoid the Brown Act violation. Retreats or workshops conducted by the legislative body. In another jurisdiction that we're dealing with, a new city manager from another state came in and said, I want to do a big strategic planning workshop, and I'd like to take the council off-site and just meet with them privately and discuss how we're going to move forward. And I said, can't do that because you have a majority of the legislative body. That would be a meeting and subject to the Brown Act. Advisory committees created by formal action of the legislative body and standing committees which have either continuing subject matter jurisdiction or a meeting fixed by ordinance, resolution, or formal action. So let's talk about serial meetings. And serial meetings is a series of communications by which a quorum of the body ultimately becomes involved in discussing, deliberating, or making a decision about official business. So there are two types. One would be sort of a chain. A member A speaks with member B. Member B speaks with member C on the same subject. And member B communicates to member C what member A told member B about the subject. There you have a chain of events that leads to what is considered a serial meeting. Then you have the hub and spoke, where you have one member that's talking to a whole bunch of other members. Member A speaks with member B, and then member A later speaks with member C on the same subject and begins to exchange information that member A obtained from member B. Suddenly you're creating what they call a collective concurrence in discussing an item. You also have the situation where an intermediary can serve in that function. For instance, the city manager or a planning official at the city who's meeting with various council members on a topic. And if that intermediary starts sharing information to one council member that he learned from another council member on that topic, you could potentially create, again, what is considered a serial meeting. Another example would be if you circulate a written proposal among members for review and signature, or you're sending out a blast email to the council members with a proposal and ask for their feedback back to you. That, again, could create a serial meeting. Exchange of emails by majority regarding issue within body's subject matter jurisdiction. Again, emails can be very dangerous. Often, city staff will attempt to communicate with a wide array of people, such as all the council members at once, to provide information in one direction. And the danger is when a council member hits reply all and responds back to the email in some way, and then suddenly other city council members are hitting reply all, and then you have a electronic serial meeting, basically. So it's very important to avoid those types of circumstances. Yes?
Would it be appropriate to blind copy the council, but let them know in the body of the email that you're blind copying them so they can't reply all? And
That would be one approach. The other approach is to put in your email, please do not respond back to this email. This is for informational purposes only, or please do not hit reply all. But blind copy may be one way to indicate that you are communicating, but you do not want them to connect with one another. So the key thing is not, creating that collective concurrence and exchanging the information. So with emails, again, do not reply to all. Do not take a position or make a commitment in emails. Email board for information only. And then one of the key issues that that is actually at the Supreme Court right now is the whole issue of information on your private electronic devices. Right now, the Supreme Court is going to decide whether or not if you have public information on your private cell phone, whether or not that turns that information into a public record, which would require you to disclose the information on your private cell phone. So the Court of Appeals has already stated no. If it's a private device, the information on it is not public. However, it's at the Supreme Court, and we should be getting a decision on that very soon. Back to Shannon.
Thank you, John. Next, meeting locations. A body must conduct its meetings within the boundaries of its own jurisdiction unless it qualifies for a specific exemption. Now, there are special rules for teleconferencing. Among others, it is possible for an individual agency or board member or city council member to call in and teleconference into the jurisdiction where they're calling in from, however, must be posted on the agenda and it must be publicly accessible. And I've actually heard of council members going down to gas stations and putting that location on in order to be meeting the requirements of the Brown Act. Now, there are certain rights of the public that are secured by the Brown Act as well. And first of all, the public may comment on agenda items before or during consideration by the legislative body. Can't require them to go after consideration. Time must be set aside during a regular meeting for the public to comment on any other matter under the body's jurisdiction. This can be unscheduled or scheduled communications. The public may criticize the agency and the public officials. Sometimes that's hard for some newer members to really kind of accept, but that's what happens. They are allowed to criticize. And the public is not required to register or identify themselves. You'll often see this, you know, please state your name and your address for the record. They can, but if they don't want to, you can't make them. So you can ask. But no, it's actually not.
It's always been that.
But I will tell you, 99% of the jurisdictions I've seen always ask, state your name and address for the record, please. So just something to keep in mind if somebody doesn't want to really do it. Yes, John.
Just a real quick point on that is there is a little bit of confusion in the area, but I think the prevailing opinion now is that you can't require it. However, you can evaluate and give due credence to someone who speaks anonymously on a topic and is unwilling to provide their name and the like. So you weigh the testimony by the person who's providing it and whether or not they're willing to indicate who they are. So you can do that. You can weigh the value of the testimony.
You can take into consideration whether or not they've done so as to how it weighs to their testimony. Also, you can't require the public to pay fees to attend a public meeting. And some people say, well, how could that possibly come up? Well, let's say you want to do a special meeting, or not a special meeting, but you want to hold a meeting in a baseball stadium to support the local team, and there's an admission fee in order to get in the door. You can't do that. The public can't have to pay an admissions fee, even if it's not to the city, in order to get into the building. Next, there must be non-discriminatory facilities. Meetings may not be conducted in facilities that exclude persons on the basis of race, religion, etc. They must be accessible to disabled persons, and members of the public must have access, again, free of charge. And there could be copying of recording. The public may obtain a copy at cost of an existing tape recording made by the legislative body of its public sessions and listen to and view the body's original tape on a tape recorder or viewing device provided by the agency. Now, what this means is there are sometimes in these cities some very old records that are using very old technology. Do not throw away your old technology, please. Leave that there unless you have a way of converting those records that they can be viewed by the public. Make sure that you still have them. Public votes, all votes except for in the case of permissible closed session, must be cast in public. There are no secret ballots, whether preliminarily or final, permitted. And taping or broadcasting. Meetings may be broadcast, audio recorded, or video recorded as long as the activity does not constitute a disruption of the proceedings. Anybody can pop out their smartphone, their cell phone, or whatever it is and record the proceedings. However, they cannot run up to do close-up shots and that sort of things if it's disrupting the proceedings. So there is a balance there. Types of meetings. Not all meetings are created equal under the Brown Act. The Brown Act actually recognizes different types of meetings as they go forward. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the regular meeting. That's the typical one that requires 72 hours advance notice, and it's the one that's typically held at a certain day of the week or the month. There's also special meetings, and special meetings can also go forward on 24 hours notice, so you don't need your 72 hours notice, but there's restrictions on what you can consider at a special meeting. For example, you cannot set salaries and compensation paid as fringe benefits of a local agency executive. In other words, you can't be raising, for example, the city manager's pay compensation or giving them additional consideration at a special meeting. It must be at a regular meeting.
Janet. And this is relatively recent. It came as a result of the Bell scandal, where lots of interesting things occurred at special meetings in Bell.
Interesting things, yes, that's a nice way of putting it. And again, you see this as a result. A lot of these laws are kind of a reaction to things that have happened, and so you start seeing bandages and patches put on them, and they're changing every year. And sometimes you end up with a little bit of a Frankenstein or inconsistent laws, but we'll try our best to get everything kind of jammed together so that we'll have compliance. There's two more types. There's the emergency meeting, and then there's adjournment, of course. If you're going into an emergency meeting, I would highly recommend you contact your counsel before you consider doing an emergency meeting on less than 24 hours notice. Usually those are very narrow circumstances when you can hold an emergency meeting. Meetings, notices, and agendas. Now, as I said previously, on regular meetings, your agenda and a brief description of each matter should be considered to discuss, must be posted at least 72 hours prior to a meeting. And I would just note to you, for those agencies that have approvals dealing with CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, please make sure that's on your agenda, as well as the consideration of the item itself. The special meeting notice is 24 hours. And the law requires you post notices and agendas on the internet as well. Most agencies do have that, and it makes it a lot easier if it's posted up, and it's a really good opportunity to reach out into the public and make them aware of what's going on. The other thing is agenda or information as to location where the documents related to the agenda can be expected. So that agenda must tell you where you can find additional documents. So sometimes the clerk's office will post it outside where it's publicly accessible and say, if you want additional information, these documents can be found in the clerk's office.
Could you elaborate a little bit on the CEQA notice? Is it acceptable to list it as a subtopic?
Yes. And it just has to be a general description. For example, I'm so sorry, Bob back there would want me to repeat the question. The question is CEQA, how do you put it on the agenda? Is it okay to put it as a subtopic? And the answer to that is, it's a very good question. Yes, you can put it as a subtopic. It can be just a very general description, such as a finding of categorical exemption under Class 4, whatever class you're being, and then the actual approval of the document after that. And since CEQA requires a board or an agency must consider CEQA before approving a project, we always recommend that the subpart, the CEQA, go on top above the actual approval below. So that's just an easy way to remember that. Do your CEQA first, then do the approval of the project or the entitlement or permit or whatever it is second. Now, the Brown Act, as you all know, I'm sure you guys have heard this probably 1,000 times, the action may only be taken on what is on the agenda. And sometimes we have a tendency, people will come up from the audience and start raising these other issues, and it's really kind of hard to keep the public focused and everybody focused. But it's only to be taken on agenda items. There is an exception, because there seems to be an exception to every rule, and that exception is if the matter came to the attention of the body after posting the agenda and they need to take immediate action. So there are narrow rules. If you have something like that coming up, one of the first suggestions I have for you is pick up the phone, contact your attorney, and figure out what you can do and how you can do it. Now, the exceptions to the open and public portion, there is an exception to those general rules, and that is with closed sessions. And the closed session, often we get the question of, well, gee, I don't want to talk about, I don't know, breaching a contract in open session. Can we do that in closed session? Or I don't want to talk about this particular thing. Can I do that in closed session? Well, the rule is, generally you can't do it in closed session unless there's an exception. It has to be a particular exception that applies to it. And it must be expressly authorized. So all items to be considered in a closed session agenda must also be described in the notice and the agenda. And there's usually sample language that they provide that you can use to put in your notice and agenda as well. Now, there are some what they call safe harbor rules that appear, and those are the exceptions for the personnel issues, the pending litigation and stuff, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But prior to each closed session, the body must verbally announce the closed session. And typically you see the district or board or agency attorney reading through, we're going into closed session based on potential or threatened litigation under government code, and they'll rattle it off. That's a required announcement that they have to do. So make sure that when you go into closed session, it's announced. And then if certain actions are taken, it must be also announced when they come out of closed session. For example, certain sort of settlements or resolutions and of those sorts of things that are approved in closed session would be announced. Now, there are some common closed session items. The first one is personnel issues. There is also public security. Body may meet in closed session with law enforcement or security personnel concerning the security of the public buildings and services. I've actually seen this one used. It's kind of interesting. The other one is pending litigation. I just mentioned this a little bit earlier. And that body may meet in closed session to receive advice from its legal counsel concerning existing litigation. The city has been sued or being sued. Initiating litigation. The agency is considering filing a lawsuit against someone. Or situations involving significant exposure to litigation. One of our vehicles just ran over a child. That may qualify you to get in. And we've been in those situations before. Now, in addition to pending litigation, other common ones include labor negotiations. Especially, you see labor negotiations, those can be involved with MOUs. You'll often see with unions or whatever the case may be with represented parties. You'll see those in closed session a lot. And you can meet with negotiators to consider labor negotiations with represented and unrepresented employees. And there's also the real property transactions and negotiations. You can meet with your negotiator, discuss price in terms of a payment and purchase, sell, and exchange, or lease of a property. You can understand why that wouldn't want to be public information if you're setting your maximum amount that you'd be willing to pay for a piece of property. It's not in the public's best interest for the seller to know that. Now, there are remedies and sanctions for violations of the Brown Act. Violations may be prevented or stopped by court order. Anybody can go in and get a court order ordering certain things to occur. Members of the public can do that as well. The action may be invalidated as if it never occurred. The agency may end up paying court costs and attorney's fees. And the person violating may be guilty of a misdemeanor. And disclosure of closed sessions is prohibited. And I believe that may be also a misdemeanor as well, technically. I don't know that I've ever heard of a council member or a board of supervisors being prosecuted for that, criminally prosecuted for it, but technically it is a misdemeanor. And I'll turn over the next part to John.
Okay, we are in the home stretch here, and we're going to talk the final transparency with regard to public records. So we're going to talk briefly about the Public Records Act. Here are some of the basics. It's designed to give the public access to information in possession of public agencies. There are limited exceptions. The agency always bears the burden of justifying non-disclosure. And stating, you know, I just don't have time to respond is not a justification, and we'll talk about that. Some portions of documents are reasonably exempt. What's covered? Well, records. And records include any writing by a local agency, and a writing includes handwriting, typewriting, printing, photocopies, meeting tapes, faxes, drawings, maps, emails. And if you're using your phone and it's a public phone that's paid for by the public agency, text messages. Staff reports. Vast majority of agency records are disclosable, and public meeting records for the Brown Act are also covered. What's not covered? Employees' private papers, unless they relate to the conduct of public business and are owned by the agency, computer software developed by a state or local agency, and records not yet in existence. And I think this is a real important point. Sometimes if you deal with public records requests, they'll ask you to not only disclose the records you already have, but any similar records that you create over the next year. Well, the first part, yes, you can request those records, but they can't require you to continually disclose records as they're created on a go-forward basis. Certain records are exempt from disclosure. An agency may withhold records but can allow greater access if it wishes. So again, as we've talked about earlier, this is what the law states with regard to transparency as to records. If you as a local agency would like to be more transparent with your records beyond what the Public Records Act requires, you can do that. Once a record is disclosed to one requester or to anyone, it is now public for all. So if you've produced it for one person and then someone else comes in with a Public Records Act request for that same document, you can't disclose it, even if you could have withheld it the first time. What types of records are exempt? Exemptions are statutory, and again, they're interpreted very narrowly. So records involving attorney-client communications, preliminary drafts, notes, and memos may be exempt. Home addresses, voter registration information, gun license information, or public housing information, addresses of certain crime victims, Social Security numbers, and real estate appraisals. Records concerning pending litigation, personnel, medical, and similar files, information technology systems, security records, arrest records, and investigation and security file. And the catch-all really is whether or not the public interest in non-disclosure outweighs the public interest in disclosure. So how that catch-all comes into play most of the time is you're dealing with privacy issues, employee privacy information, such as where their residential address is or their Social Security number, or if someone has an employment application that they've disclosed their children's names or things like that. Those types of things, it's where the public interest is in non-disclosure, and it'd be a rare circumstance where that would be outweighed by the public interest in disclosure. So in responding to a Public Records Act request, the records need to be open to inspection at all times during office hours of the agency by any person. And it's important to note that the Public Records Act requires that if you can provide the information immediately, you should do so. So if someone comes in and asks for a copy or asks to see the agenda for the next council meeting and goes into the clerk's office and asks for that, generally speaking, that's pretty much available and you can just allow them to look at it. Request for copies, you have up to 10 days to determine what documents are available and to respond. But again, that's supposed to be the outside limit. If you can respond earlier than that, you should. You can seek a time extension of 14 days for unusual circumstances. But again, those are limited circumstances, and you need to, when you're responding to a person seeking records under the Public Records Act, you need to explain to them why you need the additional 14 days and under what unusual circumstance you fall. Denial must be made in writing and provide the reason for withholding the record. And the other thing, too, is that the agency is to is supposed to assist the person seeking public records in formulating their requests. So if you're the initial request they provide to you is either incredibly overbroad, covering the entirety of the history of the city, or it's just unintelligible. You really honestly can't understand what that request is asking for. You just can't turn it back and say, you know what, we don't understand what you're seeking, or you're seeking way more than we can provide. And in that, you have to try and work with the individual. Yes?
In your list of exemptions, I didn't see anything for procurement-sensitive information.
Well, we didn't cover that here, but there are exemptions, of course, for trade secret information and the like. So we're just kind of covering the broad categories. But, yes, there are certain proprietary-type information, confidential information, that would be not be disclosable. And often it falls under specific exemptions as well as under the catch-all. So. Proposition 42 actually added to the California Constitution the requirement to comply with the Public Records Act. And then other public records laws, the Government Code, Section 81008, deals with the statements of economic interest and that they need to be made available upon request. With regard for charging of fees, there's a very limited ability to charge a retrieval fee of no more than $5 for documents that are 5 or more years old. However, otherwise you're not supposed to be charging for research or any type of efforts to actually gather the documents, but you can charge for the direct cost of copying the documents. So finally, we're going to talk about fair process. And this usually comes up in the context of a body such as a planning commission or a city council engaging in what is called quasi-judicial determinations, where you're acting sort of like a judge. Comes up in the context of approving certain types of entitlements, such as a conditional use permit. And the public expects impartiality, and the public expects fairness. In such hearings, you're expected to conduct meetings objectively, follow due process, and minimum due process requires notice, an opportunity to be heard, and act in a fair and impartial manner. Examples are employee termination hearings or permit revocation hearings. Avoid missteps. Avoid the appearance of bias or actual bias. You know, before such hearings, as Shannon said earlier, don't state, you know, there is absolutely no way I will support this project, or there's absolutely no way I could do this. Obviously, avoid, we talked about all day today, or the presentation, financial interests and decisions, personal interests that alter your decision, statements that mind is made up. Avoid that until perhaps after the hearing and after you've heard all the evidence, and relying on evidence outside of the record. So especially in the context of a hearing, you should not be going out and doing your own investigation and then relying upon that information and making a decision. Your decision should be based upon the evidence and information that's actually presented at the hearing. If you are in a situation where you do obtain information outside the hearing, you should disclose that information at the hearing so that people know of the information and have an opportunity to respond to that information. And of course, as far as the fair process, the right to compete for contracts, public contracting laws give parties an opportunity to do business on an equal basis. And the contract process, including competitive bidding requirements under the Public Contracts Code and use of requests for proposals. So we're at the end here, and we just want to do a brief summary of what we've kind of talked about in general. First of all, laws create minimum standards for ethical conduct. by public officials. The public's expectations and ethics principles create a higher standard for behavior. Remember, just because a course of action is legal doesn't mean that it is ethical or that the public or media will perceive it to be so. Ask yourself, what decision, behavior, or course of action will best promote the public's trust in my leadership and that of my agency? And finally, as we've been saying throughout the presentation, there is much more to understand. The focus of this course has been to alert you to when you need to consult the agency's attorney, FPPC, or your personal attorney. So thank you very much for your attention. If you have any questions, we're available to answer questions. And also, we did pass out a test. Did anyone get the test?
Yeah.
If you'd like, we can briefly go over the test to see if we are able to communicate anything to you today. So, question number one, if a particular course of action is legal, then it is necessarily ethical. True or false?
False.
Number two, ethic laws are generally a matter of common sense. True or false? I think the correct answer is false. As we talked about, because the ethics laws are so complicated, many times it's not common sense for these types of things. That's why it's so important to be real conscious when these issues come up. Three, a vote that is clearly adverse to one's interest is not prohibited by conflict of interest laws. False. If city council members, planning commissioners, and county supervisors have a disqualifying conflict of interest, they may observe the decision-making process from inside the room as long as they step down from the dais. True or false? Okay. So long as a member of a board disqualifies himself or herself from consideration of a contract, the official will be insulated from charges of conflicts of interest. True or false?
False.
The council/governing board may prohibit members of the public from criticizing public officials.
False.
Number seven, as long as I disclose a gift and recuse myself, I am okay. True,
false.
Right. You can exceed your gift limitations. If the board is discussing something sensitive, it may go into closed session. True or false? The answer is false because the key language is sensitive information. There are very exceptions to for going into closed session, and those are interpreted very narrowly. Number nine, board members have a right to make their own investigation as to all matters that come before them. True or false?
False.
And finally, number 10, retrieval of public records can be very costly in staff time and resources, so public agencies may charge for these costs. True or false? You can charge only for the direct cost of copying and not for the retrieval process. So again, thank you very much. We're available to answer any questions that you may have. Oh, and make sure that you've signed in and that you've gotten your certificate of attendance. I believe Dana has those in the back. So.
A public official?
No. The public.